Hello, hello everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Palace Way podcast. I'm Alex, covering for Bruno. It's been a while. And joining me as always is our co-host, Pat. How are you doing?
Doing well. Can't complain over here.
You know, skies are grey. It's not sunny Florida. Dark circles are coming over everywhere at this football club. And, you know, it's a pretty bleak time at SC25 if you go by the sort of zeitgeist of Palace Twitter and then some. But are things as grey as they seem? Joining me is, in addition with Pat, is Bobby Manzi, a regular of the pod. How are you doing, mate?
I'm very well, thank you. Yourself?
Not too bad. I'm absolutely knackered. We are on the night shift, aren't we, Bobby, recording this at 11 p.m. on the 23rd of September. So it's a bit of an unusual time, but we've been a bit chocker lately. And I want to apologise to all listeners for last week. It's one of those rare situations that we don't really have these days. But unfortunately, Bruno was indisposed. Everyone was indisposed. I'm kind of now like the Rob Holding in this situation. I'm like the seventh choice host at this point, and I was unavailable too. I've been away on holiday and work. So it was just a combination of things, really. We just didn't really have the lineup, but we won't dwell on it. Because of that, we also won't really cover Leicester and QPR in too much detail, but we will talk about the wider form of the club and obviously the cup run that we're on at the moment. I'm not going to waste too much time. Let's just jump straight into it. Let's talk all things United. Palace unbeaten in four coming in, but still searching for a first win of the league. Now I'm beating in five. I mean, obviously that improves things, but I mean, Pat, let's bring you in here. What are your overall thoughts? I'm happy for you to draw on those recent performances, but let's think about United as well here. How have you found everything?
It was another rough start. You know, another really difficult first half, and even Glasner himself after the match said that's exactly how he does not want his side to play the first half. Struggled there, but again, he showed his ilk as a manager. He made the right substitutions, he made the right changes, and in the second half we created more chances. We looked the better side despite still not having much possession. We looked very direct on the counter and dangerous and threatening. So I think a draw is a fair performance. First half was a really rough watch. We couldn't do anything with it, but the second half we really showed a lot of promise, especially after making some substitutions.
Definitely. And Pat, I just want to keep you on the ball here, if you'll pardon that pun. God, I'm so used to making dad jokes at every turn. You'll get used to them. So again, I feel like I've got to issue yet another apology for listeners. Is it good for me to be back? Well, that's for you to decide. I want to talk about that first half in particular, because more importantly, the tactical setup just clearly looked wrong from start to finish, from minute one to minute 45. It particularly wasn't great on the right-hand side as well. It's not every day we talk about a Daniel Mignon's bad performance. You know, he lost Garnacho on several occasions, not really tracking the run, but that's probably just one little symptom there. I mean, what was your sort of deeper analysis of that first half and what exactly went wrong specifically?
There was a really big, big imbalance in how we were setting ourselves up. And a lot of that had to do with United preferring to go down their right, our left-hand side, and kind of keep the ball on that side of the pitch for most of the match. But we didn't do much to help ourselves. So Nketiah was really playing right off of Mateta, right in the center there, as a true kind of striker, second striker, a duo strike partnership, whatever you want to call it. He wasn't playing on the right-hand side. He wasn't playing deep as a 10. And that left Munoz on an island. And instead of helping him out, Wharton was kind of playing in the center, trying to be that secondary defender on the left-hand side, because Kamada was going through it, Eze was going through it, Mitchell was going through it. They just needed that a little bit of assistance. So we really didn't get any help from Munoz on the right-hand side. And Nketiah was really nowhere to be found because he didn't have the ability to get the ball. And, you know, I think there was an over-reliance on our left flank. Eze did too much again. Mitchell did too much. Kamada was Kamada. I mean, playing center mid, I don't think we can expect too much from him in that position at this point. But, you know, if you look at the pass triangles and the passing trees of that half, and it was all on that side. So Wharton didn't get a chance to get involved in the match. Nketiah didn't get a chance to get involved in the match. Munoz didn't get a chance to get involved in the match. That plays into Man United's hands a lot, which is why they had so much possession, which is why they had so many chances.
I know, it was just a catalogue of errors in many ways and individual performances we could spend all day picking out. But let's talk about one player that has been on the lips of fans far and wide for a long time now, Daichi Kamada. It's no secret he's not exactly had the best start of the season. We've had Ed Melian come on and say that. We've obviously had you, Bobby, reference it before. Pat, you've referenced it. I think obviously some people have perhaps gone a little bit too far. I'm not going to suggest that's why Bruno ducked this episode because he didn't want a sort of analytical spanking off you, Pat. But Bobby, I want to just bring you in here a bit. What have been your more recent assessments of Canada, particularly in light of the last three games?
Yeah, I'm not particularly the last three games, but certainly against Manchester United, I think he was a little bit of a scapegoat. I don't think he was anywhere near as bad as people made out. Yes, he gave the ball away a bit, but his defensive quality certainly improved in that game. I thought he broke up play really well at times. I thought in the second half particularly he was better, and he played an excellent ball through to Eze, which he played off to Saad, who cut back to Eze, and then Eze made the dismal miss that could have won Palace the game. So, as I said, I don't think he was awful against Manchester United. I thought he had an okay game. I'm not saying by any means he was excellent, but it's certainly one of his better performances in a Palace shirt. So I think some of the digging out of Kamada off of Saturday's performance was probably a little bit harsh.
And just to come in on that, I mean, obviously it's the first time we've seen him really starting in the league, certainly as a as more of a deeper midfield in that pivot. Sorry, a deeper midfielder, I should say, in that pivot. That's
I
my bad,
mean,
yeah.
I took to Twitter before the game and said Kamada in the pivot with the teeth emoji. I mean, I think it was a poor decision. I don't think it's his position at all, but I don't think he was awful in it. And I just think some people have maybe given him a bit of a hard ride off of the Manchester United game that he probably didn't deserve. That being said, I think there's certainly better players that can play in the DM in our squad there. Maybe it was more of a rotation thing, a squad thing. Lerma had played. Did he play? Was it 90 minutes against QPR or at least 70 minutes he played?
Yeah.
Hughes has played quite a lot recently, so maybe it was a minutes thing. But yeah, no, I'd say I don't think he was as awful as people made out. But certainly going forward, I'd like to see the midfield duo being Walton and probably Lerma. I'd maybe consider resting Walton against Everton because I thought he was awful against Manchester United in that first half, and I just thought he looked leggy, he looked tiresome, he just didn't look fit. So I'd maybe consider a midfield duo of Will Hughes and Jefferson Lerma against Everton on Saturday.
Yeah, I have three statistics we can run by just really quick. I think these are pretty wild when you really break these ones down. So 62% pass completion per, 62% your passing completion, your accuracy, not very high. We would agree that not a percentage that you would want someone that's responsible for transitioning in and out of the middle third to the attacking third, looking to create, would have in a match. We would agree with that. 62% was Tyrick Mitchell's passing percentage. Kamada's was higher than that. Having zero passes into the final third from kind of like a deeper central midfield role. Zero in the final third. Not would look good from that position. You need someone that's going to be able to progress the ball. So we would agree with that. That was Adam Wharton. Kamada had three. And then going 7 for 20 in duels, 7 for 20 in duels. That's a 35% win rate at a position where you need to have the ball, where you need to win possession back. That would be poor. That was a Barry Eze. Kamada was 7 for 11, 64% success rate, was second on the team to Eddie Nketiah's 4 for 6. So in three hugely specific statistics, metrics for a central midfielder. You had another person that did less well than this Kamada character who seems to be getting a whole hell of a lot of slate for it. So, did he have the best performance? Of course not. Did anyone in that first half? Absolutely not. We were terrible. We were terrible. That was the worst first half I've seen us play since Glasner.
But
But
you've really brightened my spirits there. Here I was thinking Kamada was to blame for everything going wrong because I was believing the noise on Twitter. It turns out we're just shit. We're just completely awful.
first half, first half,
But
we were. We
I mean,
genuinely were.
it's really interesting there, Bobby. You got your hand up. You got all polite and schoolboy. Go on, let's bring you in.
For me, Palace fans thought they were getting with Kamada, and I think he is this player as well, but I think what they thought they were getting was a player who's had incisive balls all the time and very good going forward, very creative. And obviously, the rate he's lost the ball has left him open to criticism. But going back to that pass he played through to Eze, who knocked it off the Sar and then cut it back to Eze right towards the end when everyone thought Eze should have scored. It's that incision there that he's not shown enough. But just in that one glimpse alone, he's shown that he's got it. So I just think for him, it's more he's still adjusting to the league. He's still adjusting to the pace of the Premier League. Last season, he didn't have his best season at Lazio. He's getting back used to playing under Glasner's system. So I just think he needs to be given a little bit more slack and just given a bit more time to adjust.
Yeah, no, I agree. And, you know, after what, the maybe 70th minute or so, when he slid up into that more number 10-ish wide forward role, that's when he started to look pretty creative and start to make some incisive balls too. Just give him time. Yeah, I can't say he's been the best player for us, but I don't think anyone would in the right mind would agree to that. But yeah, he's getting just too much. Just, he hasn't been poor. He's been figuring it out. He's looked better in each match.
And I think as well, you would actually see a better Kamada if you had no Mateta, because he often looks for these technical, nice link-ups with the striker. But Mateta isn't capable of doing that. He's not that kind of player. So it's almost like, this is what I keep saying to people. I think we've got a really good crop of players. But the minute we haven't got a really good team, because the balance isn't there, you've got someone who wants to be really technical. You've got someone who just wants to put his head down and shoot. You've got Eze who wants to run around in circles at times. It's a real mixed bag at the minute, and the playing identity isn't necessarily clear. But when you have like three technical players up front in Nketiah, Kamada, and Eze, we look really good. Whereas when you've got Mateta there and you've got Nketiah trying to play off of him, it just doesn't work.
Yeah, no, I mean, you mentioned the lack of Mateta thing, and I think that's a great point to segue into my favorite front three, just in terms of excitement, and I'd like to see more of, was the Eze, Sarr, and Nketiah that we saw for maybe 15, 20 minutes in the beginning of the second half. And to your point there, having Kamada sit behind that, where he's able to play with three really kind of guys that can be super direct, can be very creative and interchange with each other. We saw some of our best football that we've seen probably all season so far, and some of those kind of counterattacks that we had and the way that we were moving with space, and it looked really nice. I'd like to see more of that. I kind of thought it was going to be Nketiah through the middle and Sarr on the right, but it really wasn't. But I mean, we talked about Sarr.
I think at that point of the game, he was just looking for pace between the two centre-halves to try and get them. So I understand why he did that. It's something that I've been saying for probably about the last two or three games behind the scenes to people like Bruno and yourselves. I've been saying that Sarr has to start. And then I actually tweeted it after the QPR game, because I just think it's abundantly clear they're lacking pace and attack. And I got crucified for it. I mean, so many people come for me on Twitter. But I just think if you watch that Manchester United game, it was just proved right. The thing that Palace are lacking at the minute, and it's exactly what Michael Olise offered you. All right, Michael Olise offered you immense quality as well. But it's just that player who can run at speed, get at defences. Because Palace keep trying to play in a transition, but they're not very good at it because they've not got anyone to carry the ball quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I think he had either the second most or the most touches in the opponent's box at Manchester United again, and he only played half of football. So Sarr's just been really direct. The like break pump stat is that his goals minus XG is the worst on the team. He should have had like a goal by now already, at least, or two. But you have to take that with the caveat of he has not had many minutes, so that's going to even out when you start to play more.
Firstly, he's not fresh. And secondly, when he's coming on late into games and Palace are behind, you're trying to find an equaliser, you're trying to find a winner. Obviously, your stats are going to be slightly inflated because you're throwing more at the game.
That's fair. And it's a shorter amount of time too, 15 to 20 minutes.
Exactly.
It's a lot different than playing a full 90. So you have to get more on him. But he has looked promising in what he's done. I wouldn't be against him getting a start.
And I mean, he put a chance on the plate for Eze to win the game against Manchester United, and it was just a shame that he look at it wide.
I mean, just to really just park it there before we go into the second half in more detail as with the tactics there. I mean, we've touched on Sarr brilliantly. I do want to give a special mention to Dean Henderson. I mean, for me, probably the best performance we've ever seen in a Palace shirt. And we've seen City away and Chelsea away from the sort of last, what, season or two. So
City away takes some stopping. Palace don't get a point there if it wasn't for Henderson.
Oh, it's fantastic. I think we still forget that game sometimes. It was good to be there in the flesh. But let's talk Dean Henderson, obviously facing his former club again, not for the first time, but admittedly, definitely with some more pressure, given that there's been a whole host of upheaval at the club and a lot of scrutiny on his position, and particularly with Sam Johnston gone, he's very much now the established number one. So do you think that's actually affecting his performances?
Football's an incredibly mental sport. All sport is such a huge mental component, but I think that's amplified when you're talking the goalkeeper. I think that they're such confidence players, and the mentality thing is so huge for them because it is like a psychological game a little bit back there. So yeah, I think it's huge for him to know that he's the guy and he's appreciated. And you know, if he makes a mistake, they're going to back him. I think that's really big for what he's doing, and he's rewarding us with some great performances to start the season.
He looks like a player who thrives on confidence, and he's flowing with it at the moment. And with a performance like that under your belt, why not? I mean, he was fairly humble in his post-match interview and spoke about the collective rather than the individual. But he, you know, it's hard not to take the smile away from his face there. He was clearly delighted with his performance, and as he should be. I mean, I can't remember the exact stat, but I think it was something like 1.68, I'd like to say, expected goals prevented that game. It was a huge amount, given that the amount of chances that United created. It was, I literally just saw that flashing up. It's just a very cursory stat, but it really caught my eye because I think it puts to numbers what we could all see very clearly, in that whether it's deflecting onto the crossbar or beyond, I think there were probably three or four key moments, particularly in that first half, where he bailed us out utterly. And I mean utterly, because we, like we said earlier, we were absolutely woeful on either flank, really struggling to do anything from the front, let alone to actually keep runs away from behind. So it was just out of this world, really. I could sit here all day listing off adjectives. I don't think we would ever do it any justice, but I mean, that second half wasn't exactly free of errors or big chances conceded either. And without further ado, I want to go and look at that in more detail as well, because how often do we say it on this pod? It was a game of two halves for Palace, completely. And that distinct change in identity and shape and Sarr coming in was phenomenal to see. So Bobby, I'll bring you in on this. What did you feel was the most significant change? There were obviously quite a few, with Lama coming in for Wharton, and obviously we discussed Sarr, but would you still say Sarr is the most significant overall in terms of the tactical change there?
I think both were significant overall, person. I don't think you can say one or the other, because Palace were carrying two players in that first half. I mean, I wrote in my player ratings, possibly harsh, possibly L'Equipe-esque, but I led with boom, 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 boom. Was Mateta even in the room? Because, I mean, he was just absolutely useless. You wouldn't have noticed him on the pitch. He had one chance to burst in behind. The ball had split the two centre-halves, and he was just static. He didn't move. He didn't offer Palace anything. And yeah, Wharton, as I've already said, they were carrying him. He didn't look up for the game. Up for the game is actually harsh. I mean, up for the game in the physical sense, like the sense. He didn't look ready to play. So yeah, both of them, whether they should have started or not is another question. But yeah, certainly those two changes were just crucial to changing the game. So I think it's hard to say one or the other.
We definitely needed a physical presence and a ball winner. We haven't really touched on Jefferson Lerma. In fact, I've not really seen many people talking about him at all. And whilst I'm not pretending he ran the show himself, I mean, how did you feel he really coped? And Pat, I'll bring you in on this. I think, you know, when you're obviously running a two-man pivot like that, it's so essential that you have a ball winner in there that's competent and capable. And with question marks over Decore's both sharpness and fitness, I think Lerma increasingly is going to be given more minutes and more scrutiny by extension. So what did you think of his performance overall?
Yeah, I think that role is really needed. And I don't know if it's just Glasner kind of experimenting with a new league for himself too, and seeing what kind of different looks he can offer or early on, and then trying to fine tune it or what, but we're very clearly seeing when you bring in a holding type, you know, a shield to that back three, that back five, that we're able to look a lot more attacking going forward. And I think if we are going to trust Glasner as much as we have, and we should. He's proven it already a bunch of times with how he makes subs and how he changes things. If you're going to trust him, you got to trust he's figuring something out here too, because that's where I get my, I feel bad for Kamada, because he's just playing where the manager's putting him. You know, he's just playing that spot. It's not his fault he's playing there. So he gets the flack when no one looks at Glasner as having an issue. So I don't know. I feel like bad for Kamada for that. But once we brought that person in, Kamada was able to play kind of that Wharton role, where he's pressing a little bit higher and being a little bit more creative, making that first kind of ball into the final third, and you look better. I think we just need somebody there to free up the second midfielder. And if it's not Decore, if he's going to be out a little bit, Lerma's the obvious choice. He should be getting the starts. He seems healthy. He played 90 minutes in two matches in Colombia over the international break. So I think we've seen enough. I think he needs to be the guy moving forward.
No, definitely. And it's, sorry, go on, Bobby.
For me as well, it's impossible to deny the quality that Lerma has. I mean, he was our person, in my opinion, he was Palace's player of the season last year. I mean, he was just excellent, whether that was at centre back or in midfield. He just wins that ball brilliantly. He's got a decent pass to get you away. I think he's excellent. So I generally think he should be starting alongside Wharton in that midfield for the short term while Decore's out. And I mean, what an option to have.
Definitely. I mean, it's all the more impressive when you consider how jaded they must be from a bit of travelling and certainly a lot of football over the international break, as Pat mentioned. And again, I think we don't give the kind of human side of those breaks the mention that they deserve. I think there's a lot of attention on the physical side, but there was a lot of travelling involved. There's a lot of distance.
The North Americans didn't arrive back in training until Thursday. Or the North and South Americans, so Richards and Lerma and Munoz didn't arrive back to training until Thursday.
Forget Matt Turner.
Yeah, Matt Turner. Not to forget about him, of course.
Except he will be forgotten, by the way. Let's just be honest. We're so sorry.
I have pretty much a no comment on his signing. I'm going to continue to have a no comment.
So, yeah, the North and the South Americans didn't arrive back in training until Thursday. Lighter session on Friday, which they always do on a match day minus one. And then Saturday straight into the game. So, I mean, it's no turnaround, really. We're talking, what, 36, 48 hours maximum?
No, definitely. And it was all the more delighted to see him come back, really. I think he's a player that we've missed dearly, particularly in light of, you know, Decore's injury. We're going to rely on them, as you say. I think it's interesting, just going back to something you said earlier, Bobby, about the game against Everton. I'm not going to preview it just yet, but that whole idea of having maybe a Hughes Lerma ultra physical pivot, particularly with Wharton and Decore needing rest, I think is something that's really worth exploring later. So let's part that.
Decore's out for 3-4 weeks. So
well, yeah, we'll need to. Let's talk a bit about Eze then. Again, we scrutinised him a bit earlier, but let's talk about some of those big chances in the second half and get back on track with United, because I think there's so much to be said there. There were two distinct opportunities late on to win the game and they simply weren't taken. But Bobby, let's go through the earlier chances a bit further in, and then Pat, maybe you can pick up the second one. Let's just talk about exactly what happened in terms of the passage of play, what happened with the shot, why it went wrong, and what you ultimately made of Eze's overall game again, because I think it's really worth honing in. He's someone that's, again, getting a lot more scrutiny. So.
Oh, Ebs, if only you buried it. I mean, just it was the moment. I mean, anyone on the pitch you want it to fall to, it's him. And I mean, if he just went the other side of the goal, it was guaranteed to go in. He's just gone for the spectacular tight angle to make it look good. And he's put it wide. I mean, my shock in the ground was just... Do you know, I've never seen Seller so frustrated at a miss. Everyone was up. The celebration had already started almost as it fell to him. And the way everyone's hands just fell to their head in just pure shock. I mean, it was just unbelievable. I can't believe that he missed it. I still can't believe that he missed it.
I mean, I was
what
in the other.
What a chance.
It's huge, isn't it?
Yeah. What a chance to score against Manchester United to win it. When Palace had played well in the second half, but off that first half, Palace should have been 4-5-0 down. So to have nicked it like that would have been remarkable. It's just, yeah, it was gutting.
We don't see performances like that anymore where we just kind of clutch it out of nowhere. It feels like a rarity increasingly. I mean, not always a bad thing.
Off the back of the first half, it had the Brighton game written all over it from the Amex, the smash and grab game.
I was in a pub full of United fans in the middle of Manchester, so I kind of had the reverse of what you just described, Bobby. It was like packed, fairly jubilant, people were optimistic, increasingly just losing their patience that United were missing that many chances. And by the time Eze took a shot like that, he had acres of space, the whole pub went silent, and I'm just sat there in the corner just trying to keep it with my mate on the down low, just watching what happens. And then you can't even go visibly head in hand, so you don't want anyone to notice that you're in a United pub. But yeah, it was there was a palpable tension to those sorts of moments. And I more going back more to the game, I think what was clear to me is I think Eze just rushed it. I just think he panicked. I don't think he realised on the cutback just how much space he had.
I think he had a lot more time than he thought. All he had to do was just, I say, take the touch and pull it in the other corner, because he had so much room the other side. He didn't have to go for the tight angle.
Effectively, sorry, go on, Pat.
That first chance, it was so very reminiscent of the goal at Anfield that he scored last spring. Just down to Mitchell playing the cutback, him just finding that pocket of space. It's a game of fine margins, as they always say. So that goes in and we're having a different conversation. I mean, it was there. Sometimes you're going to make those, sometimes you're not. You know, and unfortunately, that was one of the times he's not. But as the player he is, we hope he's going to take more than he's going
to. The other big chance as well didn't fall to Eze. It was an excellent run from Nketiah just before he was subbed off. The long shot, good save from Onana, but then the double save to Denai Sarr from a matter of yards from goal was just impeccable. And as I say, Palace had, albeit they were awful in the first half, in the second half they had plenty of chances to nick the game.
Absolutely, and then some. I mean, Pat, you mentioned there about a game of fine margins, but I think at what point does it start becoming a season of fine margins? I really want to make this point because it feels like every single game is essentially the same boat. I think the overall metrics suggest that we're pulling in the right direction, but something is deeply, deeply wrong in terms of our ability to find end product and to take advantage of the chances we're creating. I mean, we've discussed Kamada at length. We've discussed Matetia, and I love that as a duo name, by the way, Matetia. But Matetia is clearly not working, and we've tried multiple different techniques to figure it out, and it doesn't seem like the link-up's there. Obviously, we've mentioned Daichi Kamada is struggling. I mean, Pat, what needs to change for you in, say, the next three games or even just against Everton?
I mean, do you see what a certain former number seven is doing in Germany right now? Like, we lost one of the best wingers arguably in the world. We've been saying it for probably 2 years now. No one believes us, and you're seeing it right now how good this kid is. So it was never going to be a smooth transition into whatever we did. You just can't replace that. We don't have the money to pay up 100 million or whatever he's actually worth. We can't replace that. So I think we are trending in the right direction. I think we're just figuring things out. I think this is part of the plan. He never starts really that smooth or that strong, but he's going for it in the cups. He knows the importance of that. I'm really happy and satisfied knowing that we have a manager that is pushing forward in every cup competition and trying to win every competition. I love that. So I think we just need to see someone take control a little bit more, whether that's Sarr getting more minutes, whether it's Nketiah stepping up, whether it's Eze stepping up. Someone needs to help Eze. He was kind of getting the Wolf syndrome in that first half, especially of just falling into a black hole on that left-hand side and trying to do too much and taking one too many touches and losing it or playing a bad pass. So someone else needs to step up and be the Elise and just take the game by the scruff a little bit. I think we have some candidates to do it. We just have to see a little bit more of it. But if we keep doing what we're doing, I think we'll be all right. I really do. I'm not too concerned at all.
You say about the season of fine margins, or is it going to become a season of fine margins? Yes, they've missed quite a few chances, but I also look at the five games they've played this season, and I don't think any of those results there are unjust. I don't think Palace have deserved to win any one of those five games. They've not been good enough to win it. Yes, they've missed chances. All right, maybe you look to Brentford with the goal that was disallowed and maybe that could have been a different game. But performance-wise, none of those five results Palace deserve to win. They've not been good enough to win a game yet this season. I think that has to be said. And there's answers for why that is. Things aren't quite settled yet. Things aren't quite working yet. He's not quite worked out his best team. Players are still learning the system. New players are still to come into the squad. You've still got Chalobah to come in at right centre back, which I think will be massive because I don't think Richards has been good enough. So the five results, I don't think you can say it's been fine margins. Yes, they've missed chances, but they haven't deserved to win any of those games.
Dominant harvest, but not dominant games. That's a fair assessment, would you say, Bobby?
Sorry, say that again. I missed that.
Dominant halves, but not dominant games. We've seen flashes of brilliance at times, but nothing more than that.
It's nothing more than flashes at the moment, and they need to find a way to sustain performances, because at the minute performances are very drip draps. You show a wonderful 5 minutes, and then you're up against the cosh for 15, and it's just not good enough. I mean, I don't want to throw it back too much, but the West Ham game was just a prime example. 5 minutes, really great. And then we just open up defensively, let the floodgates open and don't know what we're doing. The performances have just not been consistent. They've not been sustained. And I don't think Palace have been worthy of 3 points yet this season.
I will say that the defending and the like actual tactical organization, you know, making those lines of and defending and a unit as a unit was the best against Manchester United. I think you look at it from a trending, we're trending the right way. The defense is going to be the first thing that we need to shore up. It looked nice. So we keep that and solidify that, and now we can attack moving forward. And progression is here.
They'll improve, and I'm not trying to be doom and gloom at all. I'm just trying to provide the fact that if we're going to say, oh, it was close, we could have won this game, we could have won this game, the reality is they actually haven't been good enough to win a game yet.
Exactly.
But yeah, I'd certainly agree that they're on the upward trajectory. They've got players to come back. Hopefully he's going to stick with Sarr now from the start, and we should see a vast improvement in the squad. I mean, I'm not going to say a game's massive 6 games into the season, but I actually do think that Everton game is massive next weekend, because the way they've lost games recently, Palace have to take 3 points up there. They have to go for the game from the very start, and they've got to win.
And the big problem at Goodison Park, of course, we never sodding win there. Do you know when our last win was? Bit of a real bit boring trivia slash seeing if anyone actually read the notes for this pod, but when was our last win at Goodison Park? Caveat, in the Premier League, I should say, as well.
Oh, it's probably like the 90s or something ridiculous.
It is exactly 10 years and 2 days as of time of recording. 2014, that was our last Premier League win at Goodison Park.
2021, was that our last win against Everton?
Yes, that was at home, though. That was Conor Gallagher curling it. Beautiful goal there. But he no, 2014.
Tompkins scored as well.
Yes, it's a good game, that. But no, our last Premier League win at Goodison Park, 2014. Milo Yiannopoulos had that penalty 30 minutes in. And then Frazier Campbell and Bolasie getting a decisive clutch of goals to really round off the game. This was, of course, prime Coleman Baines era, starring Lukaku before Everton really, really fell off. A certain James McCarthy that day, and of course, All-American hero Tim Howard also between the sticks there for Everton. So that's how long ago we're talking. It's serious bad luck for us up there.
Palace had a good result up there last year, though, so let's not forget about that. It was a good point.
That's true.
Under Paddy McCarthy, Oliver Glasner came in that same day. But obviously, he wasn't going to manage after being announced on that afternoon. So yeah, good result up there last year. Don't think it's doom and gloom. Don't particularly think that former results mean anything. Yes, it might have angst amounts fans about it, but for the squad, it means absolutely nothing, especially when you've added six new players in there this summer, especially when you've got a new manager who's never played at the ground before. So yeah, although we haven't won there in, as you say, what is that, 10 years? I don't think it's going to be an issue. And like I say, I think Palace have got to go there to win. They've got to throw everything at Everton. I think they will get them. I don't think they're very good defensively, which is rare for a Sean Dyche side. But if you put them up against the Kosh, they do crumble. And as I say, if Palace can play Sarr on the right and Nketiah through the middle and Eze on the left, I do think that you'll see the first 3 points of the season.
There we go, a bit of Glasner magic, but we will have to swiftly move on. Right, I want to play a game. Bruno, who is on editing duty this week, I have a very special treat for your ears, but also for the listeners, hopefully. You are this week's biggest loser. You tweeted something very baity about Doshi Kamada. The jokes aside, obviously you were within your rights to do that, but I think obviously it was what we were touching upon about, you know, is Kamada the scapegoat? I think there is a real conversation there. He's obviously, as we've discussed earlier, been a very underwhelming, but it got me thinking in a kind of, you know, Barclaysman style trend that we've seen lately. Let's just name some names. And I really wanted to draw upon one big question here. Since 2016, who is the biggest flop the club has signed in your heads? Like, for me, there's all sorts of names we could pick out here, but I'm going to kind of take the back seat. And you can think about it from a purely as a player. You can think about it in terms of the fee paid. There's so many players that haven't worked out. And although Dougie mostly gets it right, there are one or two that got away. So, Pat, let's start with you. You got any particular names that come to mind?
Yeah, so if we're thinking in terms of value per money, I think we need to look at, I don't want to say this because I love him, but Riederwald was like 9 million.
That's controversial.
That's
I love him. I love him.
What have I just
heard? I think he had incomparable value. This is where I'm going to justify and say no. I'm going to rule him out. This is me thinking out loud. But I think he had value in terms of the locker room and what he brought there. And I do believe I worked in sports. I know the importance of having something like that. But yeah, it was like £8 million for not much. I mean, in terms of value for money, that's not great. But I think he, not on the pitch, but he brought it up in terms of other areas with the club. And I'm not going to devalue that. So I'm going to rule out that, just thinking out loud.
Just to come in a little bit, I'm not going to slate you for naming him out, though. I do think, obviously, he didn't perform as we'd have hoped. But, you know, he was incredibly versatile. Sure, he only had like 5 good games, but he at least offered something. I feel like there's got to be a few players that offered essentially solid.
It was, I'm worth sure it. We'll hear a few. Against Stoke alone.
Oh God, yeah, that's a good point, actually. I forgot completely about that. Really
that
carried
is,
us in that cup run there.
He had a really good stint at left back as well.
That is true.
Yeah. He had a really good stint at left back. I always think there was a player in him. I just don't think he was ever necessarily given the chance for one reason or another. And then also we just had players that were quote unquote better.
Yeah.
And there was just never a room for him, but he was a great servant to the club. And he was an excellent guy in the dressing room for the team. Good for morale. And he knew his role and he just got on with it. And that's all you can ask for a squad player who's going to come in maybe once or twice a season.
There's also a massive butterfly effect, weirdly, between Yaro Riedewald twatting it against Stoke and me meeting Jorginho in the medical room buried under Wembley Stadium. That is a story for after this pod, but it's exactly as weird as it sounds. I'll tell you guys later. That's one I'm not putting on air. But Jairo Riedewald, what a lovely ode. We started off trying to name flops. It's ended up being a lovely tribute to probably one of the nicest blokes to ever play for the club since 2016. And of course, now in the Belgian League. So let's just say that really good move for him. Really happy he's hopefully, you know, finding his feet there and a bit closer to home as well. So all the best to him, all I can say. Great servant in many ways.
I think I don't want to say the obvious one. That's what I was trying to make it up. But the obvious one's obviously Max Meyer, right? I mean, he was supposed to be, playing with the German nationals or U21s or something very relevant for a while, great at Schalke, and then just did not pan out at all. Didn't really offer much off the pitch either, I don't think. Maybe a nice guy, I don't really know. But I think that's the one that probably is fresh in everyone's mind and everyone would probably bring up.
No, definitely. I mean, my only caveat, and I'm gonna sort of devil's advocate everyone here just to be a bit of a shit out, sorry guys, like he was on a free transfer, we got rid of him fairly quickly. Yeah, he was on high wages, but I think we cut our losses pretty quickly with him and ended up being quite a mutual termination. He ended up going to Fenerbahce and then Swiss League. He bounced around a little bit, kind of a mercenary journeyman type, and I think he's still at Lejeune in Switzerland as well. So I don't think tearing up probably the right word, but I'm sure he's a bit more settled there as well. And, you know, he's been there a couple of seasons now. So, like I say, no hard feelings. It just doesn't work out sometimes. You think you've signed the German Messi, as he was once foretold, and then he ends up being more like, well, as a few players we could name, I think probably shouldn't go there. But is Max Meyer like kind of final answer? Because, I mean, there's a few. We mentioned it off air very quickly. You mentioned the quote, the Spanish guy, Pat. I think it's quite telling that you couldn't even remember his name. It's not your fault, because I think most people can't. Victor Camarasa, formerly Cardiff City, scored the occasional free kick, streets won't forget, for that one season, 2018-19 kind of player. And then he completely fell off and disappeared off the face of the earth. I can't remember exactly where he is now. I think he's in the Spanish second or third tier. That's a Wikipedia crawl. But he's fallen down a little bit, but he's still playing fairly regularly. He's back in Spain. I mean, he's okay. Anyone else that comes to mind? Bobby's got a few, actually. Bobby, well, you mentioned 11.
I think I've just jotted 11. I think at least one of them is out of the year range. I think it's a year earlier than Bruno started supporting Palace.
that feels like we're indirectly outing him. Give him a break. Right. Anyway, Is it an actual starting 11? You got like a goalkeeper, right back, or is it just kind of a general?
I have got a goalkeeper, but I don't think I've got many defenders looking at it. I'm saying I've got like three defenders.
If I said DC were the initials of said goalkeeper, would I be getting like brownie points for that?
DC? No.
Diego Cavani? No, okay. Right. Oh, I know. Lucas Perry, another Brazilian.
I've actually got two goalkeepers.
Oh, okay. Right. Bobby, I'm going to... Let's not leave the listeners waiting, because I mean, I'm kind of curious now, right? Take us through.
I'm going to lead with the one that I know was definitely the year before Bruno started supporting Palace. So I lead with Patrick Bamford. I think he possibly played for Palace before Bruno started supporting them. But I mean, he was just awful. I had nothing about him. All right, he went on to have one decent season at Leeds. But he was just shocking at Palace. He had an awful attitude. Couldn't finish. Awful player. Steve Mandanda was my goalkeeper.
There's quite a few goalkeepers, aren't there, when you think about it? We've named three now.
Mandanda played like, what was it, four games and threw a strop and we never saw him again.
Was it a strop though, or was he just unsettled? Sorry to cut off a little bit. How rude of me. No, it was more of a...
Let's not get into it. I don't think it really needs spelling out anymore.
No, fair enough.
Then Sorloth. I mean, he's gone on to do great things, but he was awful in a Palace shirt. Waste of money on that part. I agree with Pat. Max Meyer's up there. Victor Camarasa's there. And then some rogue ones, Jaroslaw Jak,
how could we forget?
Lucas Perry and Erdal Rakip. Jonathan Benteke, because he was just signed to appease his brother. Adebayor, 100 grand a week. What was it? One
Thought
goal,
about him too.
12 games. What a waste of money that was. And my final one, I mean, he could still come good, but I doubt it, considering he's been exiled from the first team, is Rob Holding.
Rob Holding is part of Palace tradition. I love that way you ended that. That is absolutely beautiful. He's now, what, technically seventh choice centre-back, if you really think about it? If you think of Daniel Klein's in there.
The kids are ahead of him.
Yeah, I mean, that's also true. Yeah,
he's not allowed to train with the first team. He challenged his manager. His manager didn't like it, and he got told where to go.
So you can join John Texter in the kind of sin bin purgatory at Palace at the moment, given that his bid for Everton's collapsed. It's very interesting. I mean, we could spend all night talking about the politics of the board at the moment. I mean, there's all sorts to go on. Also, one last thing, Bruno, we love you, really. We just thought it was a nice opportunity to spice things up. But yeah, don't bait people. I don't think Cameron is that bad. But you're more than entitled to your opinion. And don't get me wrong, serious question marks.
I sit in the White Horse. Rubbish fan. I sit in the White Horse, I'm aware. And there was these lads at the back where the subs warm up, but right at the back of the stand with their flag every week. And whenever Gyro would come out to warm up, they'd greet him with a massive Gyro, Gyro, Gyro.
Yeah.
And every week without foul, at the end of the game, whether he'd come on or not, Gyro would come over and clap those three
people
at the start of his name every day.
That's
it was
brilliant.
Unbelievable.
And that's, isn't the, that, him and, sorry, go
at, on. At the end, they give him, I think he give, he certainly give them his shirt in his last home game. Whether it was signed or not, I'm not sure.
Can I just say, what a beautiful story. I mean, isn't that the man in a nutshell, right? I know he just did that big sort of ode to him earlier, but I mean, it's a lovely anecdote. I think, we've had, for whatever reason, players don't work out. Sometimes it's attitude, sometimes it's ability, sometimes it's simply as simple as not settling in a country. Like, it happens. It's no easy thing to move abroad as a young man in your early in your career. It can be quite a lonely place, I'd imagine. But, you know, there's definitely loads of players that haven't worked out. And these are proper pub quiz questions for later down the line, you know. Definite strong contenders for names there. So, Bobby, you named a whole 11 players. And Pat, I know you did a bit of thinking out loud. There are a couple of names where you threw around. So, final question for me today. Guns to your head. Worst Palace player we've signed since 2016. It's not Daichi Kamada. In a ship, Bruno. Bobby. Who are you going with? Pick one.
Do you know what? I'm going to be a real cop-out and go a year earlier and stay Bamford.
I'm going to veto that, Bobby. I'm going to veto that. 2016, no Bamford, no party, but a good story nonetheless.
Adebayor,
fair enough. 100k a week, good point. Pat, one player.
The worst player? Erdal Rakip.
No appearances. Currently jamming with Andros Townsend in Turkey for Antalyaspor, by the way.
Is he really?
Macedonian international, full international. Obviously, I think his real origin is in the Swedish league. I think he's raised in Sweden. So he's still had a decent career. But I mean, by all accounts, he was basically there just to put the cones out. It was a bit of a strange signing. So very, very interesting one. And I want to say streets won't forget, but the streets will absolutely forget. Let's be brutally honest.
I'll never forget the weird photo of him, though.
We could spend all night talking about these names, couldn't we? I've kind of realised this. There are some fun stories here. So I'm kind of glad that it's a kind of very backhanded way to kind of make everyone joke about Bruno. Actually, it was an okay take. He's allowed to have those opinions. I think we've ended up having some really good discussions about some peculiar characters here. So thank you very much for that. Speaking of showing some love for Bruno, really, we do actually have a serious message and a very positive one. For those who may have missed it, we were nominated for the highly prestigious Football Content Awards for best video, which I have to admit is confusing everyone here at the Palace Way, because don't get me wrong, we have a guy called Charlie who does brilliant stuff on TikTok for us. It's the Palace Way Pods on TikTok, all one word, cheeky plug. We do some video stuff. We're doing partnerships on socials now. We are doing some video stuff, but it's not really a big part of our flagship. We obviously have the website and the stuff we're doing here on the pod and the socials. But more to the point, guys, I want to say a massive personal thank you to listeners and fans who nominated us. Put simply, we wouldn't be in this position without you, and it's beyond humbling to think about where we were 3 years ago. This was just essentially maybe three or four guys on Twitter, one of which is in the Netherlands, and we just were speaking a bit about trying to create a new social project. Bobby and Pat, I'd never met you guys. Pat, I've not met you in person yet. I'll change that one day, but it's brought so many people together within the team at TPW, and everyone here puts a great shift in as volunteers, giving up their time to make this happen. And long story short, this wouldn't be anywhere without our listeners, those that, you know, follow us on Twitter, those that follow us on Instagram, those that read our articles, those that obviously listen to the pod. However you engage with us, we couldn't be here without you. So thank you very much for your support and nominations. If you want to vote for us, you can do so at footballcontentawards.com. That's footballcontentawards.com/voting. You can find all the details there. I believe we're the first tile, actually, because I voted today. You can nominate the Palace Way there to win the award. I'll stop yapping here, guys. Just my usual outro. Thanks for listening again to this episode. Hope you enjoyed. If you like what you're hearing, we'd be deeply grateful if you could leave us a rating or a review on wherever you get your podcasts from, Spotify, Amazon, and so on. Don't forget to check out thepalaceway.com for news, opinion, analysis, and more. We even have our very own Wordle, as I like to stress, which we've aptly named after Joel Ward, call it Joel Wardle. You can find us on X and Instagram at The Palace Way, TikTok at The Palace Way Pod. I'll wrap it up there. Just one final bit from me. Bobby, pleasure to have you on as always.
Thank you for having me. Good episode. Enjoyed it. Congratulations on the FCA from an outsider, looking at your content and what you do, and obviously coming on the pod occasionally, doing a great job, giving fans a real voice with a whole breadth of different opinions, which is excellent and great, and it's what everyone wants to see. From me doing the more traditional media, looking at you guys, it's excellent stuff.
Yeah, we've always tried to give a platform for people. I know that might sound a bit self-aggrandizing, but most of our writers are students, let's be honest, it's individual contributors who just want to do one-offs, and that's kind of how we roll. It's our whole ethos, you know. We want to be a kind of fan-led, bottom-up sort of organization. That's how we've always done things. So yeah, it means a lot to have you on, Bobby. Thanks for coming on today.
So anytime. Cheers. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, no worries. And Pat, closing thoughts from you.
Yeah, just add a quick little note of reasons to be optimistic. Our first seven under Glasner last season, last spring, our first seven matches, we won one match, we drew three. The win was against Burnley, and we had draws against Forest and Luton. So it wasn't the greatest of starts, but we turned that around by reeling off that unbeaten streak, starting with a huge win at Liverpool. So there's reason to be optimistic for it. That run of matches didn't coincide with losing Elise. It coincided with him coming back. That's going to be a little bit of a different thing. We have to figure it out, but I'm confident he will. I have a lot of faith in this guy, and I think he's the best manager since I've been around for sure. So stay positive.
One man who deserves time, it's Oliver Glasner. And speaking of time, thank you to all the listeners for yours. Thank you. Have a lovely week, and up the Palace.